Samuel, 1 Samuel 29. I think 4th of July is... Come on, David, this is a celebratory day. This is a happy day. We're supposed to be all excited doing it. Well, I can understand that. This is a celebration on some level, but, you know. I'm not sure that the fireworks going off on a ship had anything to do with fireworks in celebration of partying and drunkenness, but here we are. What about what?
Hot dogs.
Hot dogs, yeah. Hot dogs. I think it's important that we remain on some level sober, obviously. Sober on about what we're doing and what our purpose is. As a people, as a country, as individuals, as a church. Is our freedom from a tyrannical government the excuse for hedonism and self-indulgence? Because that obviously is a sure road to moral decay, and so it's pretty obvious we've taken that road on some level, on a big level. So, chapter 29 of 1 Samuel. Let's look at that. See if we can learn something from David. And this David. God, I thank you that you gave us a history. You gave us to teach us. You know, you give us history so that we don't repeat, so that we learn. It's not just a storybook to peruse when we feel like it, but it is a book of instruction, and I thank you for that. Solzhenitsyn said that without history, a people has lost their soul. We are rewriting our history. We don't even know why we do the holidays and the celebrations we have. We don't value the great importance. We are willing to establish a larger government, which to control and to give to us, which is completely contrary to the independence that was fought for. God, please to learn from your word. Thank you for the time to spend with these people. It isn't a matter of numbers. It isn't a matter of who isn't here, because God, I ask you to be with them and cause their day to be filled and encouraged by a greater awareness of you. There's a lot of family and a lot of things going on that are important today, and I ask you to do it. I thank you for these people that are here, though, and please bless us with a level of intimacy and a greater knowledge of you, because that's why we're here, and we all want to learn from you. I pray that, God, I pray, please, with the families, that you will cause them to be bound tighter together as they spend time here and today, and whether it's shooting and riding motorcycles or whatever it might be, going to Redfish or all the various activities that are going on with family. Please protect my brothers and sisters as they're out and spread out, that they would see the mission, because all of them, they're all in a mission state of needing to minister to families that don't know you. Cause them to remember that, and remember that's the importance. It's not about celebrating paganism or hedonism or selfishness or the right and ability to have a day off and party. It's about representing you. Thank you for bringing the Gretfeld family together here and give them the joy and intimacy and bond that you want them to have as a family. Protect them in shooting and riding and from the flies as they go out east for it. So you give them some greater appreciation of you as they see your glory. Please protect their time together and cause it to be impacted for the kingdom. Amen. So last week we talked about Saul going and visiting the medium. And in the process, having Samuel come back and talk to him. And troubling. It is troubling. It's troubling because it doesn't fit into the categories that we tend to develop and learn, the boxes that we tend to want to develop and learn of what it looks like and what it looks like when we die and where we go and what happens. And that's okay. We should always be perplexed. We should always be struggle a bit with eternal things because we're finite people. And if we get settled and confused and content with understanding God and His character and eternal things, we're not understanding God and His character and eternal things. Because God is an infinite being with infinite ways. And His ways are always right, and His ways are always true, and His ways are never contrary. But man, it's hard to figure them out sometimes. So Samuel was told that it's a wild deal. It kind of goes back and forth between 27, 28, and 29. At the beginning of 28 it says, "Now it came about in those days the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, know assuredly that you will go out with me in camp, you and your men. And David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant shall do. So Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." That was Achish is a Philistine king. We just went through the deal where, we're struggling a little bit, I'm sure all of us, because here's David, he goes to Achish, who is a Philistine king, who were the Philistines, obviously, and the Israelites were not buds, they were war enemies fighting each other. And he went there and asked for refuge, and Achish gave him refuge, and he even went to the point of giving him his own city to do it. And during that time David was there, David was about killing the Amalekites and a couple of other family indigenous groups that had been there for a long time that God had told the Israelites to wipe out completely. When they came into the country, they were completely pagan, godless. We talked about this a little bit. We've talked about it a few times. We talked about it a little bit on Thursday night, and what does that look like, and why did he do that, And again, at this point in my life, I'm in reading, especially in the last year, spending a bunch of time in the Old Testament, I'm convinced that there's a side of it, an aspect of it, that's the mercy of God. That he said, stop children being born into a culture where they are basically hopeless to know Him. That's a pretty big statement. And I think the mercy of God said enough. These people did not worship God, did not honor God, and their generationally did not worship God and did not honor God, and we tend to look at that, well, at least let them live out life and have a good time. And God realizes that really isn't important, because eternity is what's important. We're talking about this life being a snapshot, and the only thing that matters in this life is who we serve. And if we do not serve Jehovah God, if we do not serve the God of the Bible, happiness, joy, long years of life have no value. no value. In fact, potentially degenerative, negative value, because of the influence on other people and the example that we live out. And God understands that. Different than us, we're very humanistic. We believe that there's great value in enjoying life, right? And that's what we're about. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Now, God understands. He says, the joy of the Lord is my strength. You know, is a biblical quote. And that's true. You know, David said, I would have despaired if I could not believe that I'd see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. That's true. He understands us, and he understands that. You know, the distinction is that happiness outside of God is not happiness as God describes it. It's not true peace, it's not joy, it's not true contentment. You know, without the reality of Jesus Christ and the work of Jesus Christ and the submission to the Lordship of Jesus Christ and appropriating the work of Jesus Christ in our life, we cannot know freedom from guilt and shame. We cannot know freedom from the burden of sin. And without those things, we might as well drink. You better get drunk if you want to be happy, because you better numb yourself. Because guilt and shame and the burden of sin are burdensome and trash us as people, as humans. Jesus knows that. That's why he died to set us free. I mean, that's what he says. He died to set us free from the bondage of sin, from the power of sin, and from guilt and shame. And we can know happiness and peace and contentment when we're right with God and when we're free from those things. That is eternal happiness. It is well worth it. It has nothing to do with outside influence. It has nothing to do with how good things look around us. It has nothing to do. It's a peace that surpasses all understanding. And it's a happiness that goes beyond that. And that's what we should desire. That's what we should long for. And happiness outside of that is, there's things in life that God put, you know, spending time watching your grandkids grow, seeing your grandkids, you know, that's a wondrous thing. I mean, that's a joy to be able to spend time. Nieces and nephews, you know, family, beauty, guns, motorcycles. I can think of a lot of things that are joyous. So is it that bad? Am I, you know?
My mom's at the airport.
It's good. Okay. All right. Go get them. Are you guys, hanging out with your mom next couple of days?
Yeah, and then my friend Lindsay and her mom will be each out too.
When?
They're flying tonight.
Tonight. So do you need to get some camping stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, later this week? Okay.
Thank you.
You bet. So here's David. He's in the process. God has anointed him king. He is suddenly had to take on the responsibility of 600 men, their wives, their children, and all their possessions, which is all of a sudden this I'm running is one thing, and Saul's trying to kill me is one thing. And remember, he went to Achish the first time by himself. Remember? And he went there and sought refuge. I think that it was probably under the context of the Eastern code of ethics and code of behavior that said, you know, even if your enemy comes to you and asks for refuge, you give him refuge. And he went there, and Achish gave him refuge. I'm not sure. There's something more that goes on here. I would be... I think it is pretty obvious by the actions and by some of the words that are said, Achish had tremendous respect for David. And I would go beyond that and say that, and if there's something to consider, it is this, and that God uses us in mysterious ways to have an influence, even on our enemies. And our representation, our living out our faith, our living out our true belief in God and how that looks, has an influence on this world. I'm confident that this man, Achish, king of Gath, remember, Gath was a town that Goliath came from. Obviously, there was a very strong connection between Achish, the king of Gath, and Goliath. Goliath came from his town, not only Achish, but he had brothers. I speculated at one point a while back that Maybe they were bullies, you know, or something, and Achish didn't like them too much, because Achish had tremendous respect for David. Okay? When David came in the first time to the town, and David sought that refuge, because Saul, if he stayed within the territory of Saul, Saul wanted, he was gonna kill him. And so he went there and sought the refuge, and the refuge was given him, it appears, by the king, and yet the people went, "What are you doing? We cannot do this. We cannot make this exception. This is the guy that they say, you know, they at the time, this song was famous in the region. Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands, and they dance. Doesn't sound like much of a musical to us, or much of like a song, but there was some kind of catchy tune in the song that spread throughout the land, because it's repeated several times on doing this. You know, it wasn't just this thing, but the Jews, the Israelites, I mean, they sang this song and danced to this song, sang and danced to this song, and it was famous. It was that thing, you know, there was one recently, a YouTube video that went completely viral back a while. Anyway, you would all know it. You know, what is some dance, little dance song deal that went on? What's that? No. We're dating ourselves there. You know, doing it. No, it was a recent one. So, anyway, this song, this was famous, and this dance was famous, and this statement. But the people went, give refuge to this guy, and remember David. I believe David was humbled by God. I believe David was led by the Spirit of God. Okay, you can't come and go, but wait a minute. I'm David, you know, and I asked for refuge. I'm anointed king. Everybody knew he was anointed king. Even the Philistines knew he was anointed king. Everybody know, you know, the word spread, man. Here's this guy. We can accomplish a lot of things by killing me. And rather than David boldly with an ego, he did the thing that was most humbling. I mean, to slobber in your beard in that culture is like, very demeaning. You know, and David played the madman. God told him play the madman. Be insane here. And that, you know, you say, well, that was deceptive. Mm-hmm. Kind of like attacking your enemy in the dark or using night vision or bombing from 30,000 feet up in the air or stealth fighters or there's a lot of things that we do in the war that are very deceptive. Wearing camo when we go hunting, like I stated, putting animal urine on you and smelling like an animal, like a animal in the estrus, you know, so you can attract bulls and kill them. That's pretty honorable, isn't it? I'm doing it. So, but that's what we do, you know, because that's, it's not a bad thing necessarily. It's part of the process and what we're doing. David did. He ended up going, but the people here don't like me at all. End up leaving and escaping. Here he's back in Gath. Came the second time with 600 guys. I'm sure there was a little bit more different posturing because he had 600 really tough guys. I mean, these guys were the real deal, and they showed up, and it was like, oh, okay. But Achish seemed to still have. I wonder, and I throw this out, I think that Achish honored and respected the God of David. And you say, because he makes some statements here in 28 about that. I think that came from watching David. Remember when David killed Goliath? David didn't take credit for it. David didn't say, you know, hey, I'm tougher than you, Goliath, right? David said, you have mocked the God of Israel, and my God will not be mocked. And you come to me, he says, with armor, with an armor bearer, and a sword, and a spear, and a shield. I come to you in the name of my God. And he killed him. And the Israelites ran over the top of Gath and killed the man. And Achish, I'm sure, had friends and family and soldiers killed and their stuff stolen. not stolen, but taken as plunder, right? After they killed them, they ran them off, they came back and plundered their camp and took all their stuff. And, I mean, this, Achish seemed to have a respect. There's one other thing I want to throw out something too, because we talked about, remember when he gave him Ziklag, 20 or so miles away from Gath there, and he gave him Ziklag to go settle in. He was there for 16 months or something, living there at the first time. And he, while he was doing that, he was raiding others, right? Raiding in the Negev in the desert area of the southern part of Judah. And, you know, Achish seemed to think that he was doing it. And it looks very, very deceptive. And there's a side of it that, you know, I don't understand. But there's a side of it that's different. In that, when we tend to say, the thought is that David was killing Philistines and then he was acting like he was their best buddy and killing Israelites, right? But David was not killing Philistines. You need to understand that that Amalekites are not Philistines. Okay? They're completely different people. And the three culture groups that he talks about attacking and killing were not Philistines. David was not killing Philistines. So there is truth there. He was not killing the friends or the people of Achish or the people that were, you know, that he was king over or that he was associated with as a people group as far as Philistines. David was at that point, you know, had he killed Philistines? Absolutely. Under the leadership when he was leading people with Saul, had he been killing Philistines? Absolutely. Tens of thousands, it says, you know, he talks about, right? And so he had killed him, but he stopped during this period of time, it appears. I think he was honest about that. He wasn't killing Philistines. He was killing Amalekites, which are completely different than Philistines. And when he went up with these guys and traveled with them, and he was asked to go with these guys, it wasn't with the people groups that he'd been recently killing. So there was a level of, you know, it's trying to find, how do you find a level of integrity there? We also talked at one point about David seemed to be deceptive. And all of us who were raised in church, who were raised actually with a moral conscience, who were raised that lying is wrong. Right? And I agree, lying's wrong. God says, he hates a lying tongue. Now, if God hates a lying tongue, we should take that seriously. One thing that we do not take well enough, that if God hates something, we should run from it. God says he hates divorce. We should run from it. God, doing something that God hates, acting in a way that God hates, is a boldness that borders on idiocy. Because when God hates something, we should hate it too. And we should act that way on it. So, and that includes sin, you know. Sin of all sorts that God hates doing it. We should fear God, and if God hates it, I better not love it. I better not like it doing it. But this is a situation, you know, we spoke of Rahab. You guys know the story of Rahab? And Rahab, when the Israelites first came into Jericho, or first came into the Promised Land, the first city they encountered was Jericho. And this is a really, really well-fortified city. This is one of the city and warriors that was fearful for them the first time, 40 years before or whatever, when they'd gone, we can't take these cities, man. They're fortified. They've got warriors. They've got all kinds of, man, we can't do this. Now here they are back at that city again. You know, it's just an amazing thing for God to say, just be obedient and watch what I do. Because that's what he asks of us, to be obedient and watch what he does. I mean, of all ways to start things out, march around this place, blowing your horns, pardon me, looking like fools, right? You're marching around this place and blowing your horns, and the people in there are going, what are you guys doing, you know, on it? And boom, God crumbled the walls. It's been speculated, and I think, you know, she lived on top of the wall in a house, supposedly, right? And she was a harlot. but her and all the family were there. When all the walls crumbled of Jericho, her house obviously couldn't have crumbled. Would have had to remain standing. He told them to go in the house and get her out and bring her in. And she became not only their family was adopted into the nation Israel, but she became a great-great-grandmother of Jesus. Rahab the harlot. And it says, and when you read about Rahab the harlot, it talks about her as one of the great people of faith, men and women of faith in Hebrews 11. I mean, this is Rahab the harlot. She was a harlot doing it. And it never fails to give her that name. Okay? You know, that's what she was. Not, let me contend, I can pretty much guarantee she didn't necessarily continue that profession in doing it. But that's what she became. That's what she was identified with. God continues to identify her as that because of his mercy, I think to show his mercy and grace. She was adopted into the nation of Israel. She lied. She lied to protect him. Right? When the people of the city came and said, hey, we saw two men come to you, which was kind of not out of the ordinary, I'm sure. And they showed up at her house, strangers. But we believe they're spies. And she said, yeah, they came, but they left afterwards. And they hadn't left. They were hiding in the flax on her roof. Stacks of flax, I don't know, that she had stacked out on her roof. And she buried them in there and told them they left. And then she let them down and protected them. And God honored her for that. God honored her for that. On doing that, saved her and her family, adopted them in. Again, she became the great grandmother of Ruth, you know, through Boaz, and became in the lineage of Jesus. On doing that, and it all began with her lying. You say, well, how does that work? And as I've struggled with that most of my life, but as I've struggled with that recently, trying to look at this and look at David and his willingness to be deceptive, I would ask, and I'm not going to give a definitive answer and try to give you a, we all want an out when we can lie and can't lie, right? You know, we'd like that. But I want to say this, that there seems to be, when God honored even, much less allowed, a lie, like in it was never about self or self-protection. It was, and it was based and rooted in, and let's understand this, because this is something, this is the important part. The determination was based on, who do you fear most? Do you fear God or do you fear man? Now, all of us can look at almost the entirety of the lying that we've done in our life, and it had to do with fearing men, not with fearing God. It is never right to fear men and lie. We can guarantee that. If we do it for self-protection, and we do it because of the fear of men, because our fear of men is greater. We do it to protect, because we don't want to look like a fool. We don't want to look like, we don't want to take responsibility for actions. We can justify it in a million ways, which we all rationalize and justify our lies that we've done. But do we do it because we fear men and the rejection of men or the condemnation of men or the whatever? Or even for our own lives? Is it because we fear men taking our lives? And Rahab feared God, it says. And she feared God more than men. She put herself at great risk in this position. So did David. David, by doing what he did, was not self-protect. David was putting himself at great risk of losing his life. David feared God and acted in a way that feared God. And so I throw that out for you to consider. If we're ever tempted to lie and we're in the process of this rational process that our fleshly mind usually goes through, okay? Or let's just say whatever mind or spirit goes through. Is this fearing God or is this fearing men? Is this for my good or is this because I fear God? Is this self-protection? Is this for me? I mean, I can say this. If we fear God and are led by the Spirit of God, you know, who am I to say Rahab sinned and did something wrong? God doesn't say that. Okay? I'm not sitting up here going, oh, our pastor said we could lie when it worked well. Okay? That's not what I'm saying. Okay? I am saying that, in fact, I would say quite the contrary. I don't know when I have ever lied in my life, and yes, I've lied in my life. I don't know when I've ever lied because I feared God. I have lied because I feared man. And I cared about myself, and I elevated myself above God. Wasn't in a position of submission to God. So, here we have David again, okay? Verse 29, or chapter 29. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, when the Israelites were camping by the spring, which was in Jezreel. And the lords of the Philistines were proceeding on by the hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were proceeding on in the rear with Achish. Then the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, who has been with me these days, or rather, these years, and I have found no fault in him from the day he deserted to me to this day?" But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Make the man go back, that he may return to his place where you have assigned him, if that's what you think is right, but he is not to be with us. Do not let him go down to the battle with us, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For with what would this man make himself acceptable to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sing in the dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright, and your going out and your coming in with me in the army are pleasing in my sight. For I have not found evil in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, you are not pleasing in the sight of the Lord's. Now therefore return and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done? And what have you found in your servant from this day, from the day when I came before you to this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" But Achish answered and said to David, "I know that you are pleasing in my sight like an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He must not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who have come with you. And as soon as you have risen early in the morning and have light, depart." So David arose early, he and his men, to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel. Another one of those troubling ones. You know, let's just go back to the New Testament. We can talk about Jesus' love and grace and do that, right? Because we read these Old Testament things and go, oh my gosh. You know, what does this look like? You know, what is this? There's a couple of things for those of you in the last few weeks that have read and listened and been here doing it. Remember when David was, when he went down to Ziklag and he was living there and he went and killed the Amalekites and the other tribes that he was doing? It said that he was very careful to kill them all. Why? So that they didn't go back to Achish and tell him what he was really doing. Was he killing people and attacking people where he said he was in the southern part of Judah? Yeah. Did Achish seem to imply that meant that those were people that they were people in Israel? And he figured that he was making himself an enemy of the Israelites, right? Of all these people in the process. That's what Achish seemed to figure on the deal. David was killing people that God had commanded. We read in the Old Testament where God had commanded these specific tribes to be wiped off the face of the earth and killed completely and totally. And David was killing those people. You know, I contend David had read that somewhere. I mean, the history was there then. I don't sure exactly. Some are not sure if there was written word or whatever. I think there was probably written word. David wrote Psalms. So So obviously there was some written word doing it. And David was killing the people, the tribes that God had told and commanded to kill on doing that. Killing them all, making sure they didn't go back. I'm not exactly sure why, you know, maybe so they didn't go, David's killing us, well, and make question, you know, make Achish and his people questioning who he was in allegiance to. I don't know. You know, what was David going to do here? I guess my biggest question, and I'll say this, in all the time I've spent there and studying and understanding, I don't know what David was going to do. I mean, David was going with them up. And they were going to attack Saul and his men and the Israelites. And David implies, good, let me go with you and you'll see what I can do. Now, I would have to assume he was not going to kill. I mean, he had the chance to kill Saul before and he hadn't done it. I do not think he was going to kill Israelites. But he certainly continues on with this, what seems to be in some level, from our perspective, culturally, somewhat of a ruse, right? That he was going up with Achish on this process. And they were going to attack the Philistines. They did. They killed Saul. They killed all his sons. They routed the Israelites. They took over Israel in this process, in this battle. Okay? I mean, it was... and David was going with them. What was going to happen there? I can only speculate because he didn't end up going. So we don't know what he did, what he would have done. But I would submit that it talks about David being powerfully filled with the Spirit of God. I have a feeling David didn't even know what he was going to do. I have a feeling David said to his men, can you imagine when he said to his 600 warriors, come on, you guys, let's go. Where are we going? We're going with Achish to attack. Where's Achish going? Oh, he's going to go attack the Israelites. Really? Do you want us to go up here with them? Yep. And we'll find out later, his guys were not all that excited about it. You know, shortly after this, they want to kill him. Because he just let them on. So they went on this march, and they went about 70 miles north, where the Israelites were camped in Jezreel was about 120, 140 miles north. Remember, they're walking. They didn't get to take the train or the bus or the Humvees. They walking up there with their stuff, with supplies, with enough stuff to carry them, you know, right, to get them by. I mean, that's in the desert, you know. Of all places to go march. This is about halfway at Aphek. They were about 70 miles probably or so from home, from Jezreel or whatever, or from Ziglag. And this is about halfway, and they were coming, and all the Philistines were coming together. The Philistines basically lived from Israel to the coast. It was the predominant. A little bit north, a little bit south, but from there to the coast is where they were, on the coastal part. And they were all gathering together, and there was a gathering already up by Mount Gilboa. It's interesting when you look at it. I mean, Mount Gilboa where Gideon fought. You know, I mean, the battles have been fought up there, previously, and this was a, I don't know why they were clear up there. This is quite a ways north of where Saul lived. It was 50 miles north or so where Saul lived. It was, like I said, up by where Nazareth was, kind of in that same region where Jesus came from, east of Galilee. And so they were up there. Saul seemed to be up there, gathered with his men, gathered with the Israelites. And Endor was up there, even a little bit further north. It's interesting, we talked about him going to the Witch of Endor. That was a pretty wild deal because you could see Mount Gilboa basically was, if you look at it from this perspective, Mount Gilboa was here, okay? And the Philistines were camped basically here, okay? North of them even, where the gathering was. You know where Endor was? Here. Further north. So Saul had to not only disguise himself to the witch, but he had to, it was probably a, 7-8 mile deal that He had to go skirt around, evade this giant gathering that had him terrorized, right? His heart was pounding. It says that he was in terror about the Philistines. And he had to go through them, go around, disguise himself, hide himself, go. It's a really rough country, rugged country. But he went to the witch, and then he stayed up all night, basically, right? She killed the calf after doing it. He had to walk back and then go fight the battle next day. Right? So no more whining about Thursday nights, you know, being late, you know, doing it. So he stayed up all night and then went to fight the battle doing, obviously, well, he died the next day, so obviously might not have been his best. So, they were up there. These guys were heading from Gath. They were heading in. They were about halfway there at Aphek, where they had met. And this is where he told them to go back. So that's kind of the setting. And what happens. I guess to me, the pretty phenomenal, profound thing here is that Achish called David and said to him in verse 6, "As the Lord lives, you have been upright. You're going out and you're coming in." The word Lord is important here. That's the word for the God of Israel. That's Jehovah. It's Jehovah God. There's a lot of gods, and they believed in other gods, right? They had their gods. Remember when they brought the Ark of the Covenant in? They took it to their temple of their gods, Ashdod, and you know, then the people all got hemorrhoids, you know, or whatever they got on doing it, to the point where they got rid of the Ark and went to another place and happened. They put it before their gods. Remember their god Dagon? Their statue, when they brought the ark in, their stone god fell over on its face in front of the ark. And they came in the next morning and they set it back up and said, "Oh, that's kind of weird." And next day, not only fell over, but broke in pieces. Remember doing it before their god? And they said, "Man, get it out of here doing it." You know, they worshipped other gods. They did not worship Jehovah. They did not worship the God of Israel. Okay? This man acknowledges the God of Jehovah. The God of Israel is a powerful God. That's the powerful word, as the Lord lives. I mean, where did this come from? I believe that's why he had mercy and compassion towards David. It looks like later on in their life, as David becomes king, as David is enthroned as king, and David is put in that position, and David takes over, and David rules king, and David begins to fight the Philistines and conquer the land and free the land of the Philistines again, right? Because David went in there, because after this battle here, they not only killed Saul and his sons in doing that, they basically overran Israel again. Darn. And so David became king, was put in the position of king, and then David ran him out of Israel again in doing it, killed the Philistines. But it's weird. In the process, it appears there's a passage that says that Benaiah, one of David's mighty men, who was my grandson was named after this, right? Hopefully he lives up to that name. I don't know who could. He killed a lion in a pit on a snowy day. They were one of David's mighty men, and these are some guys that did amazing things. Okay, these were real fighters. Anyway, he had a group of mercenaries that fought with Benaiah that came from Gath. So, obviously, and they were fighting against the Philistines. And Gath was just outside the borders of Israel. You know, and the king of Achish was there. We suppose that maybe he was still alive. There's inference to him later on in Scripture and Kings and Chronicles. There's a reference to him being still alive. He had a long rule, it appears, as a leader, as a king. But he sent, there was mercenary soldiers, basically, that fought for Benaiah, fought for David against the Philistines. So, you know, the influence, and I don't know where else the other influence would have come, you know, I am speculating here. But I see from his treatment of David, and acting towards, he respected David greatly. It wasn't that he feared him, but he seemed to fear the God of David. He seemed to revere and fear the God of David. He was probably there, might have heard, I don't know exactly how the amphitheater of the valley worked, where David and Goliath fought, But they were yelling across. You know, the Goliath came out and for 40 days, twice a day, came out and mocked the God of Israel. And all of Israel heard it. So you weren't that far apart in this valley and yelling. And it's, you know, it's got some walls on it. It's mainly flat farm ground. It's got some hills around it doing it. But there was, they were in proximity and they heard, you know, this king of Gath, Achish, where Goliath was from, I'm sure he heard of David's words and heard of the God that David had served. And I guess I want to encourage us by this, that I don't think we don't understand. You know, David wasn't in any way, when he went out and fought Goliath, considering, oh, maybe they'll become converts. Maybe I can win them over to serve God. No, I'm going to kill them. And we're going to all kill you doing it, because they were in the middle of a war doing it. But the sphere of influence when we serve God boldly with our lives. And again, it doesn't matter what you say with your words. Achish did not respect David for his words, but he respected him for his actions. He respected him for his willingness to put his life on the line, truly put his life on the line based on his understanding of the God that he served, based on his belief, based on his trust in the God that he served. And Achish watched the powerful God of Israel. They had already heard, it comes later, this is the God, wait a minute, this is the God that's parted the Red Sea. The word was already out. This is the God that destroyed the entirety of the Egyptian army. The most powerful army probably on the face of the earth at the time in the Pharaoh. God wiped them off the face of the earth. There was already that fear that had gone ahead of them of this God, Jehovah. This God they claimed to serve. Okay? And this Achish, you know, and God not only used it to preserve David, to protect David, to fulfill his promise to David of becoming king by protecting him. But who knows what? You know, we look at the adoption, we say, well, God didn't, you know, I'm sure it's all of us on some level, and I think we've carried it over to this day, and I don't necessarily believe in it. You know, God chose the nation Israel to specifically exemplify his character and his nature and his power and his authority and who he was to the world. Right? But we say, that's kind of exclusive, and it was at the expense of everyone else. Again, remember, he took Rahab in. He took Rahab and her whole family and adopted them in as a family. You know, God, I don't believe that God has ever been exclusive. You know, it's a very dangerous tenet of hardcore Calvinism. It would say God has chosen some and God has not chosen some. And God chose the Israelites and God did not choose the rest of you, so you guys were just born to be damned and going to hell. That's a pretty scary tenet to me. Growing up, calling myself a Calvinist, if you guys no, you have to fear. There's many tenets of Calvinism that I believe in. But the extreme Calvinism is a very... What is the end result of that? That God has chosen some for death? That God has chosen some without hope? That seems to be contrary to what God says in the Bible. And it seems to be contrary to how he exampled that. It wasn't just the Israelites. Anyone who was willing to honor God. Anyone who was willing to honor Jehovah as God. God was merciful towards. God was kind towards. We tend to look at these tribe people that he said, well, you were born without hope anyway, so I'm just going to kill you. You know, you're not one of the Israelites, so I'm just going to kill you. We tend to think of this until we look at God and go, God, you're kind of a racist, aren't you? I mean, you know, you're a narrow-minded, bigot racist, aren't you? I mean, just because they weren't Jews, you wipe them off the face of the earth and kill them? Well, no, that is not God. God is not a narrow-minded, racist bigot. God is a merciful, compassionate God who says, I wish that none would perish. You know what? And he means that. He wishes that none would perish. And he gives the opportunity for all to know him. Is that when Jesus says that he died for the sins of all men? I don't disagree with that. I don't think that's an untruth. Does that mean all men are saved? Absolutely not. But to me, does it imply that all men have the opportunity? I would suggest so. Most won't choose to honor God. Most won't choose to honor Jesus for who he is. But I believe that men are given the opportunity and given the choice to do that. We have the responsibility, just as the Jews. God did not choose the Jews. Understand this. The vast majority of the Jews went to hell. Most of the people that God calls as an exodus out of Egypt and called as his people, those 1.5 million or whatever it was, 3 million, 6 million, I don't know how many, it was a bunch of them, you know. A whole bunch of them that came out of there as far as men and women and children. And they came out of there. The vast majority of them died in the wilderness. Did not enter the promised land. The implication, the truth of that is no different than today. Many are called, but few are chosen. God gives an opportunity to man to know him and to honor him. God just used the Israelites as an example to the world of who he was. And he worked, and he did work exclusively in a powerful way through them. When Jesus died, that did change. God said, no longer are the Jews my people that I am going to choose to work exclusively through. I am going to work to all people in all nations. My spirit is going to move throughout the earth to draw people to me. I'm doing it. And I don't know. You know, there's a different, I believe certainly we should support Israel because they are our only ally there. It would be stupid not to. As far as because they're the chosen people of God. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. I realize that's a big statement and I'm not stating any absoluteness there. But I think you would be hard pressed in the New Testament to find Jesus giving such precedent to his own people on doing it. That now the church are the people of God. The church are the representation of God on the earth, not Israel. The church is a representation. Does it appear that God will at some point in his coming back will establish a base of rule and reign in that area? It seems the best we can understand eschatology that he will. I'm not sure, you know, we haven't been very good, honestly, though, at understanding eschatology. You know, in spite of how we always think in every generation from the first generation during the living generation of Jesus thought he was going to be there. Paul himself thought Jesus was going to return within his lifetime. And we've all kind of missed it on eschatology ever since then. We've all had a great interpretation and perfect. We are more insightful about scripture now, so we understand it. And we have more interpretation, a greater interpretation, so we have the real understanding of what's going to happen in the last times. It's never proven to be right yet. I'm not saying that it's not wrong, that it's wrong to pursue it, that it's wrong to try to understand it, because I think that that's a valid pursuit in doing it. What'll exactly happen? I don't know. I don't know. And I'm not sure that anybody really does. God does. God knows when and what and where and how it'll look. Should we look forward to it? Absolutely. Should we look forward to Jesus coming and ruling and reigning? Absolutely. You know, we should look forward to his ruling and reigning right now. Jesus taught us to pray. He said, our Father who is in heaven, how holy is your name. Your kingdom come and your will be done on earth like it is in heaven. That's the benevolent, perfect dictatorship that he will set up. That he is Lord, that he is King, that he is Master, and we serve him on doing it on earth now. That is what our lives are to look like. You know, when he said the kingdom of heaven is at hand, he meant you. Who am I to worship? King Jesus. Who am I to be in servant to? King Jesus. Who is his whole church to be submitted to as their absolute authority and king? King Jesus. Kind of looks like a kingdom to me. When you have a group of people who are absolutely sold out to the kingship of Jesus. Will that change? Will he rule and reign in the world and come and judge the world for what it is? Absolutely. I do not think that we put enough importance on the fabric of our lives having the influence in this world that God calls us to and that God wants to and God desires to use us in. I look at David, who killed the giant, the valiant warrior of Gath, who had a tremendous impact on the king of Gath, that he honored God. He honored God by what he said. Did he honor God with his life? Was he saved? I don't know. There's lots of people who honor God in periods of time in their life. They're not saved. There's lots of people who at some point give credence or credibility to God and the truth of God and the truth of Jesus that are not saved. I don't know that he was saved, that he will be saved. We don't know that. And I can't know that. But I know that he honored God in this. You know, I mean, when he says that you are like an angel of God. That's an obvious, huge influence that David had on him. It wasn't just because he was a master deceiver liar. It was because he was a man who honored and served God. And we know that, right? We know that was the primary influence. So, let's pray. The next chapter, I would encourage you to read 30. We're about done with 1 Samuel here. There's a couple of chapters, and I encourage you to read it. You know, here's David in the midst. I mean, I don't know what he was going to do. I mean, think of that. You're following this guy and this group of Philistines who are going up there, and what are we going to do? What's this going to look like? I honestly think that the Philistine lords had it right. I think they were wise. In understanding, do not let this guy come with us. Do not let this guy bring up our rear. That is insanity. He is known as a warrior of warriors. And he has a bunch of men with him that are willing to serve him to the death. Do not let them come. They were right, I think. I would perceive that was what was going to happen. Did David know what was going to happen? Could David look him in the face and go, hey, the whole time I've been with you, I haven't killed any Philistines, have I? Nope, you haven't killed any Philistines. We wasn't lying about that. I don't think David killed any Philistines. Doesn't give us any indication. He killed a bunch of other boys that were the enemies of God. Doing it. What was he going to do? Will he go to kill Philistines later on? Absolutely. He will. Let's pray. God, I thank you. I thank you that you are above all others. I thank you that when Jesus taught us to say, how holy is your name, that wasn't a tempo or demeanor or voice or religious posture we put on and repeating that jointly in a large setting to make us all feel some sense of awe and reverence. You said to not routinely repeat scripture. What you meant by it is that we are to come to you in awe. We are to recognize you in awe. That we're to always approach you in reverence and fear and respect. I thank you that you gave us this example to us. We should live our lives out in the power in a power and authority that comes from you. In surrender, in complete total surrender to you. In the influence that we'll have on this world. That's why you leave us here. That's why you leave us here as lights in a dark place. whether it's this valley, specifically in this valley. If we're here right now, you call us to be a light in this valley. What does that look like? What does that look like? Do we look like those who lay our lives down and put our lives at risk and give up our lives completely to serve you and trust you? Are we lives that display your power and your authority and your provision? Are we lives that represent you correctly? Because if we are, we will have an influence on the Achishes, on the Philistines, on the enemies of God. On all? No. On some? Yes. And that's what we're called to do. That's why you chose the nation Israel, to save the whole world through them. Well, in a sense, Jesus came from them and gave the opportunity to be saved. But most of them didn't listen. Most haven't listened. Most will not listen. But you gave the opportunity through the representation of the nation Israel. Now you give the opportunity through the representation in the church. You say that we are your body, your representation, the physical manifestation of Jesus Christ on this earth. And we're to live that way. So that we influence this pagan world that does not know you, that worships the Asherahs, that worships the Baals, that worships different gods. That they will see that you are the true and the living God, that you are Jehovah God. Cause us to realize that we're called to, we're not called to hand out tracts and try to get people to say prayers. Not that handing tracts is necessarily wrong, it just is most of the time. We are called to live our lives on earth as examples of your authority and your power. In your greatness, to a fallen world so that they can see the representation of you and want to serve you and want to know you and want to honor you. God causes us to realize how important living our lives is to honor you. Worship of you is living our lives. It's not singing songs. Can be. But it's living our lives. In a way that honors you. In a way that represents who you are as King. Please, God, continue to have your mercy and your grace on me and on all of us as we stumble and bumble along at times in a bad representation of you. Thank you for being a Father that longs for his stumbling, bumbling children. To know truth, to live in truth, to act wisely, to grow up, to be mature. And you're willing to be patient and kind, and I thank you. Thank you for that, because without that, I would not be here for sure. I thank you for that. God causes us to go out in this world as a light, as a true representation of you. Causes us to long to represent you. Causes us to fear not representing you. Causes us to want nothing more than to walk with our dad. Than to walk with Jehovah God through this world. Not be determined by what man and the people of this world think. But be determined by what you think. I thank you for the privilege of doing that. Bless my brothers and sisters and friends that are here today, bless them, God. I ask you to bless them in a powerful way. With a joy that comes from inside. With a peace that surpasses understanding as they think of you, as they ponder on you, as they pursue you, as they serve you. Thank you, Jesus. Amen.